This is a special edition of Pig Health Today. African swine fever, intel from the front line. Today's roundtable features three U.S. swine veterinarians who recently visited China. From the University of Minnesota, Dr. John Dean. From Carthage Veterinary Service in Carthage, Illinois, Dr. Joseph Connor. Also from Carthage Veterinary, Dr. Clayton Johnson. Today's roundtable discussion was organized by the editors of Pig Health Today and is made possible by Zoetis. Here is our moderator for today's roundtable, Dr. Clayton Johnson.
It's my pleasure to host and moderate today's discussion with two of the top swine veterinarians in the world, Dr. John Dean, a professor with the University of Minnesota, and Dr. Joe Connor with our own Carthage Veterinary Service. We've each worked extensively with Chinese pig producers and veterinarians, and this August we were as troubled as the rest of you to receive the disturbing news that African swine fever, or ASF, has arrived in China. It comes to no surprise to us that the ASF cases have continued to surface in the following weeks and months. Keeping up with the outbreaks, changing status, and separating the fact from the fiction is really no small task for any of us monitoring the situation. As three pig veterinarians who just returned from the Layman China Swine Conference in Zhengzhou, China, we wanted to share our thoughts and observations from the front lines of the ASF battle. We'll focus this on discussion of the current status of the outbreak, and we'll talk about control efforts, economic impacts, and what we think are the likely outcomes of the ASF situation in China. Before we get started on today's discussion, let me give you a little background on China. It's a country you've probably heard a lot about, but I can tell you from experience, it's really a country you can only truly understand the way of life and the culture if you've visited quite a bit to understand their situation. For a little background on China, the human population over there is right around 1.4 billion people. And for context, that's about four times the size of the United States population. While we don't exactly know China's annual hog production volume, there just simply aren't accurate numbers to define that, the estimates are really staggering. We generally assume that China produces somewhere around half of the world's pork, if not more. China's a really big country in terms of landmass and geographic makeup. It's roughly the same size as the United States. And with that number of pigs on a similar landmass as the United States, their pig density is exceptionally high. It's not unusual for people to ask me, you know, is ASF in the pig-dense areas of China? And my response is always yes, because outside of the far western provinces, most of China roughly resembles Iowa and North Carolina in terms of pig density. Pig farm locations have changed in China over the last decade. There's been a shift of pigs away from the big cities in eastern China and toward the northeast of the country where the outbreak has initiated and unfortunately has maintained. As we begin our discussion, let's really start by discussing the first case. John, can you talk to us a little bit about how we think ASF might have entered China?
Yes, thanks, Clayton. We're not really sure where ASF entered as the first case, but generally it's accepted that in the Liaoning province there were a number of cases, mostly in farms feeding food waste. And therefore the assumption is that it came through meat products smuggled or possibly legally entering China that ended up in a food supply for pigs. On top of that, it was what's normally called the Georgia strain, which has predominated in Russia and Eastern Europe as the strain of ASF. That's been quite severe in its effects and, based on evidence in that area, difficult to eradicate as well.
I know, John, that the first case got reported in August. There's certainly some scuttle about that maybe not being an accurate timeline. Do we know a lot about when it was first potentially introduced?
There was a source herd for that reported first case that actually liquidated its herd somewhere around April. There were no pigs left in that herd, but when investigators examined manure left on the farm, it was also found there. I think it's more interesting that there was pork products that entered Korea and was tested on the day when that first case was reported. And it was found to be positive for ASF virus as well. And so it suggests that it was going on for some time in herds in that region, possibly also further to the northeast. But we have to admit at this time, the information coming out of China has often been limited, both by the fact that the government has placed restrictions on discussions, and also the limited ability for many of the agencies to do good epidemiologic backgrounds on outbreaks.
Thank you, John. That's, it's always a struggle to get good information out of there, which is why it's so valuable to have contacts who spent time there. Joe, I know you spent a tremendous amount of time in China during your career. You want to talk to us a little bit about where the cases we're seeing right now are located and really what's the pig density or pig population in those areas?
Yeah, Clayton, the interesting thing is that it has now moved through 14 provinces, and that would cover all the way from the north to the southern tier, still primarily based on the east side of the country. Clearly in all of the pig dense areas, though. And as you mentioned, Clayton, we tend to think of China in relationship to North Carolina, Iowa. These cases would be scattered in throughout those heavy dense areas.
And spreading like wildfire, it certainly seems like, as you track the various reporting. I mean, safe to say that, you know, Joe, you would say that ASF is just essentially widespread throughout China at this point?
Yes, it would be. And if you look at least the original and maybe the second, third reported cases, those were almost 1,000 kilometers apart. So quite long distance, and then would raise the question of how did it move between those, and then what about the unreported cases between those locations? Then since that time, then it's extended itself farther down into the southern sections.
In the southern sections, obviously, you get close to some of the geographic neighbors down there in Southeast Asia. John, I know that you're a resident epidemiologist here on the call, so what are your thoughts now that we're seeing it down just literally a couple hundred kilometers from Laos, from Myanmar, from Cambodia? Do we have potential for spread throughout Southeast Asia?
Yes, FAO has been ringing the bell for a while, saying that it is a regional concern. The outbreaks in Yunnan province are close to the borders of Laos, Vietnam, and Myanmar, and suggest, along with the fact that the border is pretty porous, it's not defended that well, that smuggling can occur. The one protection seems to be that in as much as China produces a lot of pork, it eats even more pork. And most of the pressure for transferal across borders is actually from those countries into China yet. But I'm sure there's movement of weanling pigs and of breeding stock in some cases.
You bring up a good point. Some of those other countries have fairly mature pig production, from what I understand. Joe, I think Vietnam and Thailand are fairly developed countries when it comes to pig production infrastructure, right? Those are some pretty big populations at risk.
Yes, you're exactly right. And I would concur with what John said. You'd think there would also be a Clayton people movement back across those borders and then inability to control food movement back and forth.
Let's shift the discussion a little bit here, guys. Let's maybe chat some about the structure of Chinese pork production. John, you gave an excellent presentation at LAME in China where you talked about the different types or different sections of China's hog production. You really divided it into three types. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, and this is one of the big differences with pork production in the United States and one of the big risk factors as well. There are herds that are very similar to the type of production and biosecurity measures that we take in the United States. And those are in my opinion and assessment, relatively safe. We'll probably discuss it later on, but African swine fever isn't the most infectious agent in comparison to PERS or influenza, and therefore there are control measures that can be taken. It has to develop some more, especially truck washes, as we discussed, but the outbreaks will be at a low enough level to allow those type of farms to continue and to expand. However, when we get into farms that are usually a smaller size but lack the biosecurity measures that do things such as feeding food waste, especially on farms close to city centers, so they take restaurant and household waste and feed it to pigs. In addition, they have a lot of foot traffic. They have low biosecurity on transport. There's still what I call stockyards, markets for weanling pigs that are collected and then sold and sorted. These all indicate that these farms are in big trouble, and we've seen many of the outbreaks be in that type of farm. And we really question whether they can continue unless they change the way they produce pigs and bring on biosecurity. The last category, and probably the most problematic, is what we call backyard pigs or courtyard pigs. Much of Chinese culture surrounds the idea of having your own pig in the household or two or three pigs and feed it household waste along with some food supplements. They're also seeing low levels of biosecurity, but the herd size is small enough and the contacts are less frequent, so that they may see ASF occur, but it is unlikely to stop them from rearing pigs. It's part of their culture. They have a pig to get rid of garbage or food waste. They have a pig to celebrate Chinese New Year with their family, and that's unlikely to change. And in addition, it's difficult to diagnose, because often these pigs, when they become sick, are slaughtered, or in fact, in some cases, when they die, they're still slaughtered, enter the food chain, and end up recycling through the system. So it's that middle area that will really change, and our question is, how quickly will the large farms take up the slack, the large biosecure farms?
Thanks for that, John. You know, most of what it seems like gets reported are very small populations of pigs. I mean, medium-sized populations of pigs at best. If you pay attention to the reported cases, it's rare that we see anything more than a couple hundred pigs get reported. Do you think, John, that that's really a function of where the outbreak is occurring right now, or do you think that's simply where the reporting is occurring?
I think it's both. First of all, there is higher biosecurity on most of the large farms. There's been a couple large farms reported, one of 20,000, another of 12,000. So there are some, especially around the cities. The second problem, however, is, as you mentioned, that the indemnity payments probably don't cover the losses for the larger farms, in that they may be associated with brands or actual farm names traded on public trading sites, and the reputational losses may be too much really to report it. So there is cynicism in the market. There are rumors of larger farms not reporting and simply doing, as some Americans have called, shoot, shovel, and shut up. But it's really hard to measure.
Scoop, shovel, and shut up. That's a heck of a containment method right there. Joe, you're a guy that wakes up thinking about biosecurity. I want to put you on the spot a little bit to ask you about biosecurity with ASF, because I think it's a really unique disease relative to what we think about. John hit the nail on the spot that a lot of the transmission appears to be through household waste, restaurant waste, but really just the carcass. These carcasses of the dead pigs appear to be a bigger risk than the live pig itself. How does that make you think about biosecurity for this disease, Joe?
Well, Clayton and John, it is a huge concern, because as we think about where that country is with its day-to-day marketing, they not only rely on individual slaughtering pigs for the Chinese New Year and for other holidays, but a lot of their pork is still displayed and consumed through the fresh markets. And because of that, then, a big part of their marketing is for a individual buyer to go out into the individual pig pens or individual finishing barns. And very common in even the modern production would be finishing barns that might hold 500 pigs and be cared for by one individual. That procurement buyer goes into the barn, identifies that pig, pulls it generally with the owner, and sacrifices that pig, and then they proceed to dress and take that pig to the fresh market. So some immediate challenges in those processes. So that person that is identifying that pig for harvest will then frequently go to another barn very directly. Then you have how do you manage and control the blood and offal this out of those pigs. And then you have the transport and the display of that pig throughout the day, hanging in a fresh open market, of which the consumer then is picking out or identifying their part of the carcass that they want, cutting it off, taking it home. So you have always a cross traffic that is occurring. And John, I think another interesting thing you identified, and it really illustrates the culture response. So even in new farms, they build dorms, and they frequently have a pre-admittance dorm. And that pre-admittance dorm is for staff members that would go back on their days off to their family. And because the culture frequently is then to sacrifice a pig as a member of that family, they would then be exposed. And so one of the differences in the biosecurity between here and there is those staff members then are required to stay outside the pig complex that they work for maybe either 24 or 48 hours and then enter the complex itself. I think another thing too, Clayton, that their markets, many of the slaughter plants are not to the quality that we're used to here, both in terms of traffic of pigs in and out and in terms of sanitation. And there's a general lack of any transport washes, bio dries, except in the new units that are being built today. One of the things that we have moved away from here in the U.S. that's a risk, the dead animals, normal mortality, is still generally retrieved from that farm through a rendering service that is managed by the government and will go farm to farm. There is a strong lack of understanding about how to manage those drop points, and because of the cross-traffic roads location of many of these courtyard farms or backyard farms, there's if they are going to remove the deads, there's tremendous opportunity of just direct crossover traffic.
Joe, you talked a little bit about the packing plant situation in China. You know, we shared in the introduction that the pig populations have shifted as environmental concerns have risen. The Chinese have really responded in a smart way, and they've moved the pigs away from the cities, generally up to the northeast part of the country where we're seeing a lot of the outbreaks. Have the packing plants and shackle spaces migrated with those pigs? Are they now in those same locations, or is there a lot of transportation of pigs across provincial lines and long distances to get these pigs slaughtered?
Clayton, that's where there remains a physical disconnect, because the slaughter plants typically are not located close to at least the growth areas and the pig dense areas, and so they have to transport pigs generally, unless they're going to these little local slaughter plants for the fresh market, they have to transport them across provinces in a lot of cases. And So immediately then that became and is problematic if you restrict a slaughter point, where are those pigs going to go? And if you restrict movement out of a province, then where are those pigs going to be slaughtered? So a huge separation generally and a huge challenge for them.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a very difficult situation to manage. And then you've got the various different types of markets on top of it. John, you want to talk to us a little bit about your experience with the markets and from an epidemiological standpoint, the risk not only that the slaughter pigs going to slaughter make, but then the meat itself going throughout the country?
Yes, exactly. The markets are quite complex, and one of the challenges in working with ASF and some of the restrictions on transport is the disruption in the market as well. As Joe mentioned, there is an excess of pigs compared to slaughter capacity in the Northeast, and yet purposely those pigs were placed in the Northeast to reduce water contamination and to more effectively use the manure as much of the corn was grown up there as well. And therefore, pigs are simply in excess, and a gradient across provincial boundaries was as much as $100 per hog. And it's not hard to imagine that some transportation could occur illegally, and we've seen some of that long-distance transport of pigs showing up as cases in disparate centers. The good point is that the Chinese government is starting to identify this as a real problem and trying to allow transport of pigs from farms with high biosecurity and even out some of that supply challenge. So I'm optimistic in the future that they're going to address some of those cases. As Joe mentioned, it's a challenge of how pork is moved, how offal is moved, and I should add as well, blood meal, spray-dried blood plasma have also been mentioned as potential contaminants of feedstuffs, and rumor has it, especially in some of the wider spread outbreaks, such as Inner Mongolia, feed appears to have been a factor. And in turn, the Chinese government has restricted or banned the use of these pig-derived products in feedstuffs. I think the other aspect to emphasize that Joe presented was how thoroughly pork is involved in the culture an activity of people. We see stands of fresh pork in the streets. That pork is bought on a daily basis, brought to homes. We see pigs transported on the back of motorcycles. We see carcasses slung over the back of bicycles, and that's in a country with four times the population and a higher consumption of pork than in the United States. It's hard to underestimate the amount of movement and contact points that need to be managed to control this disease. And thus, we end up with a certain amount of pessimism whether or not it can occur.
John, one other thing you triggered too is we think about the differences in the industry compared to ours is that the feed mills, even though they now have a restriction from feeding pork products, those tend to be multi-species mills. So they feed ducks, chickens, fish, maybe cattle out of those mills. And it's my understanding that the porcine products have not been removed totally from the mills, but they've been removed from the restricted from the pig feed. So as we learned here with PED, if we contaminate a mill, we still got the opportunity to then contaminate our pig production.
And Joe, I hadn't thought of that aspect, and I'd even add there's a lot of multi-species farms of ducks and pigs or ducks and pigs and turtles, and therefore that contamination could continue on these farms as well.
Guys, we've talked a little bit here about some of the government response and the strategies that have been laid out, the restrictions on feeding. Those plans are only as good as the implementation. What do you think about compliance with those control strategies? Is it realistic to expect, number one, that those are practical to implement, and that, number two, they're actually going to be implemented?
As I just think about the difference in the industry and the challenge it would be to educate even us here in the U.S., but you take that and you take 60 or 70% of still courtyard pigs and the ability to get information to them and to have them act on that information, I believe is just a huge challenge.
I would add two factors there. I would add the fact that it's difficult to imagine how a culture surrounding pig production and feeding food waste and having pigs as part of the community could change immediately. Culture trumps strategy many times, and I just think that this type of pork production is just ingrained into much of the culture, especially in rural areas. I would add as well that the technical capabilities of the veterinary community and even the epidemiologic analysis that can occur at government agencies is limited. And until that capacity starts increasing so that the steps are understood and justified and taught throughout the industry, it will be difficult to make those changes.
John, you trigger a memory because as here in the U.S. before Jeske's disease, pseudorabies, we would have been running pigs behind our cattle in our lots. And it took us quite a while to stop that procedure.
Yeah, and I remember going to stockyards with my uncles and my dad, and it was as much a social event as a good action on an economic basis.
John, what's the wild pig status in China? You know, we hear a lot about wild pigs in Europe. Is there risk in China that they pose the similar level of threat, and is there any plan for it if there is?
I've heard various statements on that, and it hasn't been a studied area. First of all, we need to differentiate between wild boars, such as seen in Eastern Europe and Russia, and the feral pig situation, which is probably more similar to what we have in the United States, in that it tends to be a combination of domestic pigs with some wild boar breeding added to that, and in some cases older breeds of pigs as well. Some of those potbelly pigs may survive a longer period of time out in the landscape. Most of the Chinese people I've spoken to think that it's a relatively low risk. It's a much bigger risk to have this virus continue in that backyard, courtyard pig population than it is in the feral pig population, and therefore not much attention has been paid to it. Second of all, they say, well, if it does become a problem, they'll go along the lines of Bulgaria, where 90 to 95% of that population was eliminated through concentrated and quite effective hunting plan.
How about carcass risk, John? We talked a little bit with Joe about how he would think through the biosecurity of the carcass risk. What ultimately can they do with the carcasses on these contaminated farms to eliminate the ASF risk where we know it exists?
That's probably the biggest challenge, Clayton. It's not only the carcass, but the meat that comes from that carcass. And as I suggested beforehand, there is a bias to utilize the carcasses of sick pigs from any number of diseases, and therefore allowing that to continue to circulate beyond the farm. Rendering with the right heat treatment is an effective manner, but that has been done poorly in many cases in China due to the high energy costs. I don't have quick answers there, and it's probably one of the big factors that needs to get under control. It's actually a small proportion of the population that has been identified to be as infected or within the range of contact of those cases. I guess it's up to a bit over 50 that have been identified and addressed. It's the unidentified cases of overall mortality that needs to be addressed, and Joe, you probably got better estimates of mortality rate, but as you look at the population of pigs, half the pigs in the world, and let's say 25-30% of those pigs are dying, it's hard to imagine there is one efficacious method to get rid of all those carcasses.
Yeah, John, I find that is challenging also because if we think about the courtyard or backyard pigs, a lot of them are raised out in front of the house in a small shed on a concrete slab in town or in villages. And so the first thought is that if they do have dead pigs, then how are they going to rid those pigs? And their choices would not necessarily be burial because of lack of land to do it that they would control. So that leaves either consumption, rendering, or just allowing the carcass to be there. None of those which are conducive to controlling this particular virus. One other security contamination source is that the corn that ends up even in the large systems is grown in quite small areas of land, and that corn is typically dried out in front of the individual house with natural sun drying, allowing for cross-contamination not only by people but also by other varmints. And the ability to manage that corn today in any other manner, I think, remains also quite a challenge for them.
Guys, we've talked about feed risk now. We've talked about carcass risk. We've talked about the cultural impacts of the way the food waste is used to feed livestock, the live pig markets, and John, as you pointed out, culture eats strategy for breakfast. So the control goals can be one thing, but it's tough to overcome culture. John, I do have to ask you this question as our resident epidemiologist. I think I know the answer, but in the near term, is ASF going to be eliminated from China?
Simple answer is no. There's just too much of the virus out there right now in an uncontrolled fashion that it's hard to imagine any steps being efficacious enough to essentially eradicate it.
Sure. I want to take a little bit of time here with you guys to dive into a case study and go into the microscope a little bit and see maybe what ASF is like on a pig farm. We've all kind of heard a little bit about it, but thank goodness none of us have actually been there to diagnose it. And Joe, you and I got a chance to sit down with a veterinarian and review a case on really a modern pig farm. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I sure can. We often think and we often report that the clinical signs are from an acute disease, quite high mortality. But we don't want to lose sight of the fact that the incubation period of that virus is from 4 to 19 days. And so the typical case reports is that they have a small number of pigs that are clinically sick, but they have a lot of pathogens they've got to differentiate from, whether it's classical swine fever, PRS, could occasionally be FMD, as well as now African swine fever. And so commonly it may take 1 to 3 weeks for the death loss or mortality to ramp up. The first clinical sign frequently is lethargy of the pigs, and then discoloration of the ears and the extremities, and then progression from that, as well as loss of appetite. But that case, those pigs ran quite high temperatures, and they did have the lethargy, the slowness, loss of appetite that is commonly reported. In that particular case, the veterinarians, because they had experience, were quite quick in making the diagnosis. Unfortunately, it took some time for the laboratory confirmation to catch up with the gross confirmation. Then when those pigs are necropsied, the common finding is hemorrhages throughout the internal organs, so particularly the spleen, kidney, livers. And one of the, I think, interesting things, Clayton, and it was very similar in that case that John referred to, though, within a facility, that virus doesn't move very quickly. And so that also is good, but it could be, it is a restrictor in terms of early diagnosis. You and I have shared other cases where in confinement situations, it doesn't necessarily move outside of the building for quite some period of time, and it moves very slowly between the pens. As I mentioned, that's good, but it also can delay accurate diagnosis and suspect of ASF being the underlying cause.
One of the things I hear you saying, Joe, is it's an insidious disease. I mean, it's there and it's implanted in the farm really before that mortality ramps up because it doesn't spread very fast. And you mentioned that it took a little while for the lab to catch up with the clinical signs and the gross assessment by that veterinarian. Can you talk us through a little bit why that situation happened? I mean, you'd think that lab would be all over it and they'd get those results right away, as big a deal as this is.
Yes, in that particular situation, actually the gross diagnosis is based on necropsy and based on experience, but the confirmation, the time the samples got to the lab, got a return back by a PCR confirmation, they, even though the request was they go ahead and euthanize those pigs, they were restricted until the confirmation came back from the authorities. And we always got to keep in mind that the transport to and the mechanism of getting samples to lab and the number of laboratories that we are used to here in the U.S. is entirely different in that country.
Yeah, that's fair. One of the things I heard John at the layman conference repeatedly was that it's really not very easy to get these tests done for the reasons that Joe mentioned, and maybe even some restriction on the ability for producers to test even when they've got clinical signs. How much, John, does that hinder the investigation and therefore hinder the control or elimination efforts?
Well, I think there's three steps in getting the diagnosis. First of all, having the farmer realize that this is a not normal situation. And I go back to the backyard pigs, that what Joe described in many cases is, first of all, diagnosed as blue ear disease. And if a courtyard a group of pigs, let's say one or two or three, die with discolored ears, it seems to be regularly written off as something else than ASF. And that's the first challenge. The second challenge is getting the veterinarian onto the farm or someone with some advanced diagnostic capability to then in turn submit samples and get a response back or get government personnel involved. And that take some extra initiative. In as much as it's a slow-moving disease, what we've seen in many of the cases reported from China is that over half the pigs have either died or have clinical signs by the time it's identified. That's a real concern. Then last of all, there is a real restriction on which labs can handle these samples and provide a diagnosis, and there's extra stringent transportation guidelines on moving these samples to diagnostic labs, and that can restrict how quickly samples are submitted, and then also that only certain labs can do it. And frankly, we in the United States have some of those same restrictions. And so that combination has really stretched out the identification. So I think the maximum I've seen on reported cases in China is about 85% of the pigs affected before the case is diagnosed and addressed.
Even if it's spread quite a bit through the herd and you still have 50% of the pigs alive, the euthanasia and then removal of all those animals, the disposal of the carcasses, is a tremendous amount of work. And as we've mentioned on the carcass side, a tremendous amount of risk. Joe, in that case study, can you talk a little bit about how those animals were euthanized on that farm?
Yeah, the typical methods of euthanasia are actually electrocution. And in that particular case, one of the support functions that does occur in China is that they bring in a tremendous number of people in order to carry out the process. And I think in that case, Clayton, they said as many as 50 came in from the government, veterinary team, and then took charge of euthanasia of those pigs. We often forget, but something we've got to consider here in the U.S. in terms of how do we manage euthanasia for large groups of pigs and be efficient, not only in the process itself, but also a removal of those pigs. Generally, when those are removed, in that case, those pigs then are buried locally there on the site.
Yeah, Joe, I mean, you point out that in China, they really have a couple of unlimited resources. Concrete and steel are pretty easy to come across, but, you know, with 1.4 billion people, labor is not a concern in China. We don't have that luxury of labor not being a concern here in the U.S. How concerned are you about our ability to effectively manage a euthanasia situation for any sort of foreign animal disease that might require it here in the U.S.?
Well, I am concerned. It's one thing to be able to euthanize small populations. It's another when we start thinking about a 5,000 sow farm in stalls or small pens and a 4,800 weaned to finish as an example. Just the manpower that it takes to carry that process out and then the manpower it takes to dispose of those carcasses is going to require quite a coordinated effort by a number of people.
John, from a spread standpoint, do you think that's a significant risk the U.S. needs to think about, that our inability to execute a mass euthanasia plan and to correctly handle those carcasses is a risk that we could prolong an FAD infection, whether it's ASF or anything else here in the United States?
Oh, undoubtedly. Speed of reaction is an important factor. We saw some of those challenges with the avian influenza outbreak here in the upper Midwest a few years ago when, for instance, layer flocks are quite a large scale, up to 5-7 million birds on one site, and just the labor required to euthanize those birds and remove them was something that delayed some of the depopulations. Unfortunately, in that case, probably the likelihood of aerosol spread is higher than in the case of African swine fever, though we can never rule out any mode of transmission when the numbers get that high.
Yeah, scary stuff. Let's shift gears a little bit, guys, and talk about the economic impact to the Chinese producers. John, you brought up before the spread of, you know, up to $100 per pig. I actually pulled some numbers this morning on estimates of RMB, the Chinese currency, per kilogram, and then translated those by province to give our audience some idea of that. If you're selling a market hog today in Inner Mongolia or in, say, Jilin or Liaoning province, where we really had some of the early cases and prolonged impact, you're looking at about $170 a pig is the number that I came up with for a 130 kilogram, about a 285-pound market pig. And while producers would probably be doing backflips right now to get that, for your China producer, that's not really paying for the cost of production. Now, if you compare that to the unaffected areas and really the areas that need pigs to fill the shackle spaces because they don't have the pigs right now, the pigs have moved away from them and they're near the population centers, you're looking at closer to $345 a pig for the same size pig. And, you know, John, as you pointed out, that's going to encourage people to move pigs in any location, any country. Any pig producer is not going to look at that basis difference and say, boy, I can't take advantage of that. And you see that come through as well if you look at the stock prices of some of the companies. You know, Joe, you and I work with a couple of companies over there that are extremely large companies. And the, a company like, say, Wins, which has a lot of their productions located in an area that hasn't been tremendously impacted, they've held their stock price really nicely through this outbreak. They aren't increasing it, as you would expect, because everybody's concerned about the whole country, but it's holding. And you look at another producer that's just unfortunately dialed right into that northeast area. Their stock price has really tumbled over the period since the reporting began. It's putting them in a really tough position. I'd be curious, Joe, to get your thoughts on the long-term implications of this. I mean, ultimately, how's that going to drive integration, consolidation, et cetera?
Well, Clayton, I think it will drive modernization from both the economic differences, but also from the political pressure and movement from the government to move the production in not only less pig-dense areas, but in a much more coordinated system. Having said that, it's going to take years for that to happen.
Joe, what do you ultimately think are going to be the long-term implications of this as it means for consolidation and integration of that industry?
I think, Clayton and John, that it does have both short and long-term implications. I think it will accelerate the shift to modern, so movement away from the courtyard, backyard pigs into a much more coordinated system as we see here today, and ultimately probably traceability. At the same time, though, if we think about our immediate risk, that's still a long-term horizon. This is going to accelerate that change and maybe reduce it by 50% of what the estimates were for total modernization. They face a number of challenges in order to accelerate that, but I'm sure they will address them very expediently.
Thanks, Joe, for those comments. And I would just add that I think there is a very short-term effect of availability of capital to allow that expansion of modern hog production to occur. It has expanded quite quickly, as mentioned, especially in the Northeast. We've seen that investment in the Northeast essentially stop, and I think it will stop until there is a rebalancing or of supply and demand of pigs and perhaps a loosening of transported product. I'd also add that there is going to be changes in the way pigs are slaughtered and the location of slaughter facilities in the Northeast closer and balanced with pig production, and thus in addition to that, there's going to be an increase of chilled pork product being sold within China. And I think a greater acceptance of that product in comparison to the unchilled product that often shows up on the streets.
As we think about the availability of pork really throughout China, the movement bans put a significant hindrance on that, given the lack of that chilled infrastructure right now, that chilled pork supply chain. Joe, how long do you think the Chinese government's going to continue the movement bans on hogs and or meat?
Well, Clayton, we've actually seen some uplifting of some of the movement bans, at least between provinces, and we've also seen lifting of some of the restriction of breeding stock that could move from a confirmed negative province into a infected province or restricted province. So what we do see is that they are moving through the process and allowing movement of pigs as they deem safe. The underlying thing is, though, that we don't have a feel for undiagnosed cases, as we've previously talked, and whether that is a good strategy only in the short term and a very poor strategy in the long term.
John, do you have any sort of a feel for how the Chinese consumers have reacted to this? And do you think that there's prospects for expanding pork exports, imports for the Chinese, exports for everybody else into the country here in the short term until that shackle space gets reallocated to different provinces?
Yes, I think that's going to occur. I keep on explaining ASF as not being really a disease concern as much as a trade concern, whether it be within China from province to province, region to region, or outside of China from country to country. And opportunities will develop with the need to maintain the supply of pork within China. We haven't seen much of a decrease in pork consumption other than that which is created by increased prices especially some of the southern regions. So it looks like the messaging that ASF is not a human health concern seems to be coming through quite clearly. Where that pork is going to come from to supply that need within China, as you know, there are trade restrictions on pork coming from the U.S., but others such as Europeans and Canadians and Brazilians are developing that trade relationship quite quickly.
Well, it's good to hear that there'll be pork moving throughout the global supply chain because, Joe, I have to think eventually that'll help U.S. producers.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And from our side, we'd have to still say, Clayton, we can be low-cost, highly competitive producers, and we should have that opportunity to be part of that supply chain.
We can't talk about U.S. production without hitting on a little bit the risk to our country. You know, Joe, what do you see as the risk that in the Americas and specifically in the United States that ASF introduction is imminent or happens here in the near future?
Well, that risk is going to continue to increase until we see what and when it peaks in not only China, but the other southeastern countries. Through SHIC, our Swine Health Information Center, and the funding, we certainly have a much better knowledge base today, Clayton, on what some of those risks are. And so recently, we've identified the survivability in certain ingredients, and then as you know, there have been some calculations about how long we should store those certain ingredients. The second thing would be that is we look at the number of supplies, products that come in from not only China but other supply countries that would have ASF endemic. It has made us rethink about how do we either switch those sources, but in many cases we cannot switch those sources. And if we can't switch those sources, then what steps do we take here? And so the steps for our industry are to store at room temperature for a calculated time period and to try to look at mitigants that we could add to our diets that would inactivate the virus. The important thing for us is to, right now, rethink through those steps and have those steps put in place, particularly as we go through the next 6 to 12 months.
Very good. John, what are your circles of influence, other epidemiologists and experts that you talk to, say about the risk to the U.S.? Do they pinpoint anything specific that we need to be working on harder today than we are?
I think the first source of risk is just the amount of infected pigs in this world. In other words, the infectious pressure on the U.S. We need to recognize that it is increasing leaps and bounds, not only in China, but some of the outbreaks in Eastern Europe have to cause real concern. And it's one of those cases where biosecurity reduces the amount of transmission and in turn reduces the amount of ASF viruses that can travel long distances. And the thing we keep on mentioning is we can never make biosecurity technology into a competitive technology. In other words, we're much better off when our neighbors, fellow producers in China and Romania and elsewhere are better at biosecurity, and in some cases our hope is they're better than us. And so that education and that involvement on an international basis, I think will have a real effect upon the safety of American producers as well. The second area is, as mentioned, there's known knowns, there's known unknowns. We're not sure exactly what's happening. And then there's the unknown unknowns that we have a hard time imagining. With PEDV, we recognized in retrospect that feed container transportation and lack of sanitation could have been the method of transmission between countries. And so we need to investigate what are the possible mechanisms, especially when the disease is as prevalent as it is. One of my big concerns and one of the discussions going on right now is that the disease has not been reported in Guangdong, around the area between Hong Kong and Guangzhou, where all the container shipping goes on and so much transportation is and materials are sourced in that region going to the U.S. And how can we start putting a control and sanitation on any number of materials and fomites that are transferred from China to the United States?
Guys, let's wrap up here with some final thoughts for the audience. You've got the microphone now, Joe, and what do you ultimately want to share with your take-home message for the U.S. pork industry in terms of global ASF status, and what's that mean for the long-term outlook for all pork producers?
Well, I think, Clayton, the important thing is we must continue to be aware. We must continue to be knowledgeable of the movement, not only in China, but other Asian countries, as well as in the European countries, and accept that risk is going to increase, as John said, until some future time when the amount of virus starts to stabilize within the population. So what we want to do is totally review what we're doing today with respect to all incoming products, visitor rules, downtime rules. We also want to keep working with our government to be certain we're managing the swill risks that occur here in the U.S. and brought through international cargo traffic. And then we must continue to fund research. The thing that does excite me, Clayton, is that we are much further along today than we were 4 years ago with respect to understanding some of those risks. We want to continue to fund that research, continue to fine-tune, and then continue to look at opportunities to mitigate that risk. I think we all recognize that we cannot eliminate that risk given international traffic. So can we find a funnel point that we can intervene and then really mitigate that risk so that we do ultimately decrease the risk to our pig population?
Excellent feedback, Joe. Tremendous. Be aware and knowledgeable, leverage research, continue to fund research to build that awareness and knowledge, and ultimately accept the risk. It's going to be there. Identify the pinch points, put a control plan in for those pinch points where we can control it. Thank you. John, turn it over to you. What's your take-home message for the U.S. pork industry as it relates to ASF status and long-term outlook?
I tend to make 2 points, Clayton. The first point I make is that ASF is actually not a scary disease as far as a disease to control in the American swine industry. It moves relatively slowly. Once identified, we have control measures and to trace movement so that I have no doubt that we can get this disease under control. The violence is not really from the disease, but from the economic effects. The restrictions on trade, the restrictions on movement are actually at a level that are hard for producers to imagine, and thus involvement in programs such as secure pork supply. In some states, there's actually more exercises being done as far as modeling how it will affect the industry, how restrictions will roll out, and we just need to get a better imagination of the economic insults rather than the disease insults to really start investing in preventive measures and taking a close look at those risk factors and actually paying to create a more secure industry within the United States.
I think you bring up a great point there, John, in terms of the secure pork supply. That program's made a tremendous amount of progress in terms of gaining some understanding throughout the industry, but I still think most folks know the name and really haven't committed to saying, what do I need to do to participate? And I'd urge any producers out there that if you're not involved today, please take a look at it. There's excellent information on the web, and you can also work with your veterinarian, reach out to them. Contact anybody on this panel. We'd be happy to talk you through what you need to do to help mitigate the trade and economic impact that ultimately will cripple all of us if we're not careful. I'll make a few closing comments here and then we'll sign off for this episode. I would like to start out by thanking our distinguished panel of participants, Dr. John Dean, professor with the University of Minnesota, and Dr. Joe Connor with us here at Carthage Veterinary Service. I really couldn't have handpicked two better people to share with us about China, to give us practical updates after their trip to the front lines of this battle against ASF. And I really hope in my closing thought that we keep those front lines right there. Let's keep the battle in the currently infected countries and not have that battle jump across the oceans onto our own country. I'd also like to thank Mr. Joe Feeks and his team at Pig Health Today for really helping coordinate this effort, and I absolutely have to thank Zoetis for their sponsorship. Thanks to you, the listener. Really appreciate you being with us today and hope we get a visit with you in the future.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of Pig Health Today. This program was made possible by Zoetis. Visit pighealthtoday.com for the latest news and information on pig health and welfare. You can also sign up for updates at pighealthtoday.com/subscribe.